Chapter 53. The Sabbath afternoon, after the three drunken priests nailed their unsigned, unsealed, untestified, and consequently void sentence of excommunication to the door of our chapel, the people had gathered from every part of our colony into a large hall of the courthouse of Kankakee City to hear several addresses on their duties of the day, and they unanimously passed the following resolution: resolved that we, French Canadians of the county of Kankakee, do hereby decide to give our moral support to Reverend C. Chiniki in the persecution now exerted against him by the Bishop of Chicago, in violation of the laws of the Church, expressed and sanctioned by the councils. The stern and unanimous determination of my countrymen to stand by me in the impending struggle is one of the greatest blessings which God has ever given me. It filled me with a courage which nothing could hereafter shake. But the people of St. Anne did not think that it was enough to show to the bishop that nothing could ever shake the resolution they had taken to live and die free men. They gathered in an immense public meeting on the Sabbath, after the sham excommunication, to adopt the following address to the Bishop of Chicago, a copy which was sent to every bishop of the United States and Canada, and to Pope Pius IX. To His Lordship Anthony O'Regan of Chicago, we, the undersigned, inhabitants of the parish of St. Anne, Beaver Settlement, seeing with sorrow that you have discarded our humble request, which we have sent you by the four delegates, and have persisted in trying to drive away our honest and worthy priest, who has edified us in all circumstances by this public and religious conduct, and having, contrary to the rules of our holy church and common sense, struck our worthy pastor, Mr. Chiniki, with excommunication, having caused him to be announced as a schismatic priest, and having forbidden us to communicate with him in religious matters, are hereby protesting against the unjust and iniquitous manner in which you have struck him, refusing him the privilege of justifying himself and proving his innocence. Consequently, we declare that we are ready at all times, as good Catholics, to obey all your orders and ordinances that are in accordance with the laws of the gospel and the church, but that we are not willing to follow you in all your errors of judgment, in your injustices and covetous. Caprices, considering Mr. Chiniki as a good and virtuous priest, we have unanimously decided to keep him among us as our pastor. Therefore, praying your lordship not to put yourself to the trouble of seeking another priest for us, more yet, we have unanimously decided to sustain him and furnish him the means to go as far as Rome, if he cannot have justice in America. We further declare that it has been dishonorable and shameful for our bishop and for our holy religion to have seen coming under the walls of our chapel, bringing the orders of the Prince of the Church, a representative of Christ, three men covered with their sacerdotal garments, having their tongue half paralyzed by the effect of whiskey, and who, turning their backs to the church, went to the house and the barn of one of our settlers, and there emptied their bottles, and from there, taking their seats in the buggies, went toward the settlement of L'Herbe, singing drunken songs and hallooing like wild Indians. Will your lordship be influenced by such a set of men who seem to have for their mission to degrade the priesthood and Catholicism? We conclude hoping that, changing your determination, you will work to the welfare of our holy religion and not to its degradation, into which your intolerant conduct would lead us, and that you will not persist in trying to drive our worthy pastor, Reverend Charles Chiniki, from the flourishing colony that he has founded at the cost of the abandonment of his native land, of the sacrifice of the high position he had in Canada, that you will bring peace between you and us, that we shall have in the Bishop of Chicago not a tyrant, but a father, and that you will have in us not rebels, but faithful children, subscribing ourselves the obedient children of the Church. Signed, Theodore Dorin, D. T. Vanier, J. B. Bellinger, Camille Beturney, Stan Lasgagni, Atone Elaine, J. B. Lemoline, Oliver Sinchel, Basil Allaire, Michael Allaire, Joseph Grissi, and Joseph Allard, and 500 others. This address was reproduced by almost the whole press in the United States. It fell as a thunderclap on the head of the heartless destroyer of our people. But it did not change his destructive plans. He published the most lying stories to explain his conduct and to show the world that he had good reason for destroying the French congregation of Chicago and trying the same experiment on St. Anne. With very few exceptions, the press of the state of Illinois, whose columns had so often echoed the cries of indignation raised everywhere against the tyranny of Bishop O'Regan, took sides with me. Hundreds of priests, not only from Illinois, but from every corner of the United States, addressed their warmest thanks to me for the stand I had taken, and asked me, in the name of God and for the honor of the Church, not to yield an inch of my rights. Unfortunately, those priests disclosed their cowardice by putting in their letters absolutely confidential. However, this did not disturb me. My trust was not in my own strength, but in His protection. I was sure that I was in the right, that the gospel of Christ was on my side, that all the canons and laws of the councils were in my favor. My library was filled with the best books on the canons and laws passed in the great councils of my church, and all stood in agreement with the course I had taken. Above all, knowing the unanimous will of my people, that I should remain with them and continue the great and good works so providentially entrusted to me in my colony, and regarding this as an indication of the divine will, I determined to remain in spite of the Bishop of Chicago. But if he were spiritually powerless against me, it was not so in temporal matters. His power and his desire to injure us had increased with his hatred since he had read our letters and seen them in all the papers of Chicago. The first thing he did was to reconcile himself to the priest Lebel, whom he had turned out ignominiously from his diocese some time before. That priest had since obtained a fine situation in the Diocese of Michigan. He invited him to his palace and petted him several days. I felt that the reconciliation of those two men meant nothing good for me. The air was soon filled with the strangest rumors against me. It was said everywhere that Mr. Lebel was to bring some charges against my character, that I would be sent to the penitentiary. What were the new iniquities to be laid to my charge? No one could tell. But the few partisans and friends of the bishop, Messieurs Lebel and Spink, were jubilant and sure that I was to be forever destroyed. At last the time arrived when the sheriff of Kankakee had to drag me again as a criminal and a prisoner to Urbana and deliver me into the hands of the sheriff of that city. I arrived there on the 29th of October, or the 20th of October, with my lawyers, Messrs. Osgood and Paddock, and a dozen witnesses. Mr. Abraham Lincoln had preceded me only by a few minutes from Springfield. The jury having been selected and sworn, the Reverend Mr. Lebel was the first witness called to testify and say that he knew against my character. What he knew against my character? Mr. Lincoln objected to that kind of testimony and tried to prove that Mr. Spinks had no right to bring his new suit against me by attacking my character. But Judge Davis ruled that the prosecution had the right in the case that was before him. Mr. Lebel had, then, full liberty to say anything he wanted. His testimony lasted nearly an hour and was too long to be given here. I will only say that he began by declaring that Chiniki was one of the vilest men of the day, that every kind of bad rumor were constantly circulating against him. He gave a good number of those rumors, though he could not positively swear if they were founded on truth or not, for he had not investigated them. But he said there was one of which he was sure, for he had authenticated it thoroughly. He expressed a great deal of apparent regret that he was forced to reveal to the world such things which were not only against the honor of Chiniki, but to some extent involved the good name of a dear sister, Madame Bossy. But as he was to speak the truth before God, he could not help it. The sad truth was to be told. Mr. Chiniki, he said, had attempted to do the most infamous thing with my own sister, Madame Bossy. She herself has told me the whole story, under oath, and she would be here to unmask the wicked man today before the whole world, if she were not forced to silence at home with severe illness. Though every word of that story was a perjury, there was such a color of truth and sincerity in my accuser that his testimony fell upon me and my lawyers and all my friends as a thunderbolt. My God only knows the weight and bitterness of the waves of desolation which then passed over my soul. After that testimony was given, there was a lull and a most profound silence in the courtroom. All the eyes were turned upon me, and I heard many voices speaking of me, whispering, "The villain!" Though innocent, I wished that the ground would open under my feet to conceal me from the eyes of my friends and the whole world. However, Mr. Lincoln soon interrupted the silence by addressing to Lebel such cross questions that his testimony in the minds of many soon lost much of its power, and he did still more damage to Lebel's false oath when he brought my 12 witnesses, who were among the most respectable citizens of Bourbonnais, formerly the parishioners of Mr. Lebel. Those 12 gentlemen swore that Mr. Lebel was such a drunkard and a vicious man, that he was so publicly my enemy on account of many rebukes I had given to his private and public vices, that they would not believe a word of what he said, even upon his oath. At 10 p.m., the court adjourned to meet again the next morning, and I went to the room of Mr. Lincoln with my two other lawyers, I could see in the face of my lawyers, though they tried to conceal it, that they were also full of anxiety. "My dear Mr. Chinookie," said Mr. Lincoln, "though I hope tomorrow to destroy the testimony of Mr. Lebel against you, I must concede that I see great dangers ahead. There is not the least doubt in my mind that every word he has said is a sworn lie, but my fear is that the jury thinks differently. I am a pretty good judge in these matters. I feel that our jurymen think that you are guilty. There is only one way to perfectly destroy the power of a false witness. It is by another direct testimony against what he has said, or by showing from his very lips that he has perjured himself. I failed to do that last night, though I have diminished to a great extent the force of his testimony. Can you not prove an alibi, or can you not bring witnesses who were there in the same house that day, who would flatly and directly contradict what your remorseless enemy has said against you?" I answered him, "How can I try to do such a thing when they have been shrewd enough not to state the date of the alleged crime against me?" "You are correct. You are perfectly correct, Mr. Chinookie," answered Mr. Lincoln, "as they have refused to precise the date, we cannot try that. I have never seen two such skillful rogues as those two priests. There is really a diabolical skill in the plan they have concocted for your destruction. It is evident that the bishop is at the bottom of the plot. You remember how I have forced Lebel to confess that he was now on the most friendly terms with the Bishop of Chicago, since he has become the chief of your accusers, though I do not give up the hope of rescuing you from the hands of your enemies. I do not like to conceal from you that I have several reasons to fear that you will be declared guilty and condemned to a heavy penalty or to the penitentiary, though I am sure you are perfectly innocent. It is very probable that we will have to confront that sister of Lebel tomorrow. Her sickness is probably a feint, in order not to appear here except after the brother will have prepared the public mind in her favor. At all events, if she does not come, they will send some justice of the peace to get her sworn testimony, which will be more difficult to rebut than her own verbal declarations. That woman is evidently in the hands of the bishop and her brother priest, ready to swear anything they order her, and I know nothing so difficult as to refute such female testimonies, particularly when they are absent from the court. The only way to be sure of a favorable verdict tomorrow is that God Almighty would take your part and show your innocence. Go to him and pray, for he alone can save you." Mr. Lincoln was exceedingly solemn when he addressed those words to me, and they went very deep into my soul. I have often been asked if Abraham Lincoln had any religion, but I never had any doubt about his profound confidence in God since I heard those words falling from his lips in the hour of anxiety. Unable to conceal my distress, burning tears were rolling on my cheeks while he was speaking, and there was on his face the expression of friendly sympathy which I shall never forget. Without being able to say a word, I left him to go to my little room. From 11 p.m. to 3 in the morning, I cried to God and raised my supplicating hands to his throne of mercy, but I confessed to my confusion It seemed to me in certain moments that it was useless to pray and cry, for though innocent, I was doomed to perish. I was in the hands of my enemies. My God had forsaken me. What an awful night I spent. I hope none of my readers will ever know, by their own experience, of the agony of spirit I endured. I had no other expectation than to be forever dishonored and sent to the penitentiary next morning. But God had not forsaken me. He had again heard my cries, and was once more to show me His infinite mercy. At 3 a.m. I heard three knocks on my door, and I quickly went to open it. Who was there? Abraham Lincoln, with a face beaming with joy. I could hardly believe my eyes, but I was not mistaken. It was my noble-hearted friend, the most honest lawyer of Illinois, one of the noblest men heaven had ever given to earth. It was Abraham Lincoln. On seeing me bathed with tears, he exclaimed, "Cheer up, Mr. Tenneke. I have the perjured priest in my hands. Their diabolical plot is all known, and if they do not fly away before the dawn of day, they will surely be lynched. Bless the Lord, you are saved." The sudden passage of extreme desolation to an extreme joy came near killing me. Unable to utter a single word, I took his hand, pressed it to my lips, and bathed it with my tears of joy. I said, "May God forever bless you, dear Mr. Lincoln, but please tell me, how can you bring me such glorious news?" Here is the simple but marvelous story, as told me by that great and good man, whom God had made the messenger of His mercies towards me. Quote, "As soon as LaBelle had given his perjured testimony against you yesterday," said Mr. Lincoln, "one of the agents of the Chicago press telegraphed to some of the principal papers of Chicago. It is probable that Mr. Tenneke will be condemned, for the testimony of Reverend Mr. LaBelle seems to leave no doubt that he is guilty. And the little Irish boys to sell their papers filled the streets with cries, 'Tenneke will be hung! Tenneke will be hung!' The Roman Catholics were so glad to hear that 10,000 extra copies have been sold. Among those who bought those papers was a friend of yours called Terrine, who went to his wife and told her that you were to be condemned. And when the woman heard that, she said, 'It is too bad, for I know Mr. Tenneke is not guilty.' 'How do you know that?' said the husband. She answered, 'I was there when the priest, LaBelle, made the plot and promised to give his sister 280s of good land if she would swear a false oath and accuse him of a crime which that woman said he had not even thought of with her.'" "If it be so," said Terrine, "we cannot allow Mr. Tenneke to be condemned. Come with me to Urbana." But that woman, being quite unwell, said to her husband, "You know well I cannot go. But Miss Philomene Moffat was with me then. She knows every particular of that wicked plot as well as I do. She is well. Go and take her to Urbana. There is no doubt that her testimony will prevent the condemnation of Mr. Tenneke." Narcisse Terrine started immediately, and when you were praying God to come to your help, He was sending your deliverer at the full speed of the railroad cars. Miss Moffat has just given me the details of that diabolical plot. I have advised her not to show herself before the court is open. I will then send for her, and when she will have given under oath before the court the details she has just given me, I pity Spink with his perjured priests. As I told you, I would not be surprised if they were lynched, for there is a terrible excitement in town among many people who from the beginning suspect that the priests have perjured themselves to destroy you. Now your suit is gained, and tomorrow you will have the greatest triumph a man ever got over his confounded foes. But you are in need of rest, as well as myself. Goodbye. After thanking God for that marvelous deliverance, I went to bed and took the needed rest. But what was the priest Lebel doing in that very moment? Unable to sleep after the awful perjury he had just made, he had watched the arrival of the trains from Chicago with an anxious mind, for he was aware, through the confessions he had heard, that there were two persons in that city who knew his plot and his false oath, and though he had the promises from them that they would never reveal it to anybody, he was not without some fearful apprehension that I might, by some way or other, become acquainted with his abominable conspiracy. Not long after the arrival of the trains from Chicago, what was his dismay when he saw the first name entered was Philemon Moffat. That very name, Philemon Moffat, who, some time before, had gone to confess to him that she had heard the whole plot from his own lips when he had promised 160 acres of land to persuade his sister to perjure herself in order to destroy me. A deadly presentment chilled the blood in his veins. Would it be possible that this girl is here to reveal and prove my perjury before the world? He immediately sent for her when she was just coming from meeting Mr. Lincoln. "Miss Philemon Moffat here," he exclaimed when he saw her. "What are you coming here for this night?" he said. "You will know it, sir, tomorrow morning," she answered. "Oh, wretched girl, you come to destroy me," he exclaimed. She replied, "I do not come to destroy you, for you are already destroyed. Mr. Lincoln knows everything." "Oh, my God, my God," he exclaimed, striking his forehead with his hands. Then taking a big bundle of banknotes from his pocketbook, he said, "Here are $100 for you, if you take the morning train and go back to Chicago. If you would offer me as much gold as this house could contain, I would not go," she replied. He then left her abruptly, ran to the sleeping room of Spink and told him, "Withdraw your suit against Chenecky. We are lost. He knows all." Without losing a moment, he went to the sleeping room of his co-priest and told him, "Make haste, dress yourself, and let us take the train. We have no business here. Chenecky knows all our secrets." When an hour of opening the court came, there was an immense crowd, not only inside, but outside its walls. Mr. Spink, pale as a man condemned to death, rose before the judge and said, "Please the court, allow me to withdraw my prosecution against Mr. Chenecky. I am now persuaded that he is not guilty of the faults brought against him before this tribunal." Abraham Lincoln, having accepted that reparation in my name, made a short but one of the most admirable speeches I have ever heard on the cruel injustices I had suffered from my merciless persecutors. His terrible denouncement of the rascality of the priests who had perjured themselves proved how wise they had been to fly away and disappear before the opening of the court, for the whole city was ransacked for them by hundreds who blamed me for forgiving them and refusing to have my revenge for the wrong they had done me. But I really thought that my enemies were sufficiently punished by the awful public disclosures of their infernal plot. It seemed that the dear Savior who had so visibly protected me was to be obeyed when he was whispering in my soul, "Forgive them and love them as thyself." Was not Spink sufficiently punished by the complete ruin which was brought upon him by the loss of the suit, for having gone to Bishop O'Regan to be indemnified for the enormous expenses of such a long prosecution at such a distance, the bishop coldly answered him, "I had promised to indemnify you if you would put Chiniki down, as you promised me, but as it is Chiniki who has put you down, I have not a cent to give you." Abraham Lincoln had not only defended me with the zeal and talent of the ablest lawyer I have ever known, but as the most devoted and noblest friend I ever had. After pleading during two long sessions of the court of Urbana, without receiving a cent from me, I considered that I was owing him a great sum of money. My two other lawyers, who had not done the half of his work, asked me $1,000 each, and I had not thought that too much. After thanking him for the inappreciable services he had rendered me, I requested him to show me his bill, assuring him that though I would not be able to pay the whole cash, I would pay him to the last cent if he had the kindness to wait a little for the balance. He answered me with a smile and an air of unimitable kindness, which was peculiar to him. "My dear Mr. Chiniki, I feel proud and honored to have been called to defend you, but I have done it less as a lawyer than as a friend. The money I should receive from you would take away the pleasure I feel as having fought your battle. Your case is unique in my whole practice. I have never met a man so cruelly persecuted as you have been, and who deserves it so little. Your enemies are devils incarnate. The plot they had concocted against you is the most hellish one I ever knew. But the way you have been saved from their hands, the appearance of that young and intelligent Miss Moffat, who was really sent by God in the very hour of need, when I confess it again, I thought everything was nearly lost, is one of the most extraordinary occurrences I ever saw. It makes me remember what I have too often forgotten, and what my mother often told me when young, that our God is a prayer-hearing God. This good thought sown into my young heart by that dear mother's hands was just in my mind when I told you, go and pray. God alone can save you. But I confess to you that I had not faith enough to believe that your prayers would be so quickly and so marvelously answered. Now, let us speak of what you owe me. Well, how much do you owe me? You owe me nothing, for I suppose you are quite ruined. The expense of such a suit, I know, must be enormous. Your enemies want to ruin you. Will I help them to finish your ruin, when I hope I have the right to be put among the most sincere and devoted of your friends?" "You are right," I answered him. "You are the most devoted and noblest friend of God ever gave to me, and I am nearly ruined by my enemies. But you are the father of a pretty large family. You must support them. Your traveling expenses in coming twice here for me from Springfield, your hotel bills during the two terms you have defended me, must be very considerable. It is not just that you should receive nothing in return for such work and expenses." Well, he answered, "I will give you a promissory note, which you will sign." Taking then a small piece of paper, he wrote, "Urbana, May 23, 1856. due Abraham Lincoln $50 for services rendered. Signed, C. Chinnicky. He handed me the note saying, "Can you sign that?" After reading it, I said, "Dear Mr. Lincoln, this is a joke. It is not possible that you ask only $50 for services which are worth at least $2,000. He then tapped me with the right hand on the shoulder and said, "Sign that. It is enough. I will pinch some rich men for that and make them pay the rest of the bill." And he laughed outright. The relaxation of the great strain upon my mind and the great kindness of my benefactor and defender in charging me so little for such a service, and the terrible presentiment that he would pay with his life what he had done for me, caused me to break into sobs and tears. "Father Chinnicky, what are you crying for?" "Dear Mr. Lincoln," I answered, "allow me to tell you that the joy I should naturally feel for such a victory is destroyed in my mind by the fear of what it may cost you. There were in the court not less than 10 or 12 Jesuits from Chicago and St. Louis who came to hear my sentence of condemnation to the penitentiary, but it was on their heads that you have brought the thunders of heaven and earth. Nothing can be compared to the expression of their rage against you when you not only wrenched me from their cruel hands, but you were making the walls of the courthouse tremble under the awful and superhumanly eloquent denunciation of their infamy, diabolical malice, and total want of Christian and human principle in the plot they had formed for my destruction. What troubles my soul just now and draws my tears is that it seems to me that I have read your sentence of death in their fiendish eyes. How many other noble victims have already fallen at their feet?" He tried to divert my mind at first with a joke. "Sign this," said he. "It will be my warrant of death." But after I had signed, he became more solemn and said, "I know that Jesuits never forget nor forsake, but man must not care how and where he dies, provided he dies at the post of honor and duty." And he left me.